bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, that's me. Hi.
Gentlemen, glad you're all here. I'm going to talk about some stuff with you.
Oh, cool.
Glad to be here. Glad we're alive.
Couple interesting things. Just a thing I want to throw out there. Right before the show, I was playing with the Rubik's Cube, and because like, I haven't played with one forever. And then I'm like, I want to go see if there was a documentary. And I watched a little short one on Rubik, the guy who invented the Rubik's Cube. Really convenient that his name was the name of his invention, by the way. Funny story, I did not know. You know, he made the thing originally to like teach students about like design and other stuff. Wasn't really intentionally the game, and he realized it had game applications. So here's Rubik. He makes the first Rubik's Cube. And then he decides to solve it. It took him a month to solve this.
Wow, the creator. I mean, I guess because he doesn't have the... If you create it, you don't have all the methodology and the meta, right?
Yeah, like up until then, nobody ever solved one before. So I think that's pretty impressive. But just the idea that, you know, he's like, let me try to solve this. A month to solve it. And it's just, I thought that was kind of amazing that like the guy makes the cube and like, I guess I'll try to solve it a month. Now the record's like 4 seconds because we have all these algorithms and stuff. But I just thought it was kind of a neat, you know, neat story. The account that he made it and then like I tried to solve it. Took me a month.
Damn.
When you back away from it, it's like, do you realize it only took 3 seconds to smash this window and it took 7 hours to put it back together? I mean, it's like, you know, entropy. The game is.
I would have no context for it in terms of like, you know, you invent a thing and then it becomes that popular, like, and people want to solve it. I mean, like, that is such a story of engagement that this the idea that this would even be a thing that people played around with, let alone would live so long, let alone would have any actual kind of applications, let alone would be so popular that oh, so many years later, there are speed people that are doing it for 4 seconds. It's just crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, when he made it, it wasn't like, originally this is going to be a game. It was a neat thing he made. But just the idea of like no concept of where the thing would go, what it would end up being. It's just, I think, kind of a neat thing. And also being, you're the first guy to play at the Rubik's Cube. Like, what do you do with it? What's supposed to happen? You know, at that point, you know, it's just, you know, you just call it the Magic Cube.
There's part of me that's so dialed in on knowing that there's a set of best practices that I'm quite literally scared to learn because if I do, I'm afraid I'll fall into the same rabbit hole everybody else has. And so to me, it's a bit of like intentional looking away constantly. Like, I don't know. I don't want to know. It's that hard cube that you just spin and eventually give up and peel off the stickers and redo them.
Yeah, I think that the neat thing is like learning a couple algorithms can be neat because then you can kind of go, oh, okay, you can solve it. And that's kind of, I think, kind of the fun of it is to learn a couple. But then like, you know, these speed cubers who solve it in 4 seconds, they know hundreds of algorithms, you know, and again, it's not a knock on Rubik, like, oh, it took him a month to solve. It's like, no, like, I even think that the fact that he could solve it, not knowing if it was going to be possible, but how many combinations there were going to be is amazing. But just, yeah, you look at like that accumulation of where, you know, the world championship now goes between, and there's the Netflix documentary on it, which we're showing playing in the background. And one of the world champions, he's autistic.
Yeah. You know? I mean, and this dude is blazing. Jeez. And we're watching the footage here now. Jesus. Yeah, it's a fascinating world. I mean, you know, we can only hope that our art has the same kind of engagement and popularity as the Rubik's Cube.
Yeah, it's amazing how long it's stuck around. And something you would think like would be, you know, it's that simple too. Because like I was watching a movie the other day and like they want to show the guy who's the clever guy. So what do? Rubik's Cube, you know, Armageddon, Steve Buscemi, want to show he's clever. There's the Rubik's Cube. And it's become this sort of, you know, you know, and having a lot of free time can be a symbol for being smart now, which is cool.
You're a genius. You know, we know that you're going to know the thing at the end because you did a Rubik's Cube once.
I mean, it's easy to eye roll at it, but that is the kind of thing that I look for when it comes, when somebody wants to intern or really, I mean, even a college degree is really nothing other than a certificate of, I was able to see through a four-year project. And it's like, and you were observed the whole time? Yes. And you suitably did it? Yes. It's like, okay, yeah. You could be our intern, whatever.
So now I know I'll never go to work for you. Thanks, Brian. So let's do a quick diversion there. So let's do the college take. So you were saying regarding completion of something, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, to the best of my ability, a college degree really doesn't say much outside of either you came from a place of privilege or you at the very least have the ability to spend 4 years seeing something through to completion. I think that's the fairest thing. And I suppose I'm thinking about it a little bit more because I have three daughters who are on very different tracks. And I don't know that all three of them, I don't know that I want all three of my daughters to go to college because I think it'll be a waste for some of them. Especially if Ryan Holiday, the author of The Obstacle is the Way, Trust Me, I'm Lying, Ego is the Enemy, he says, if you're going to college to get a piece of paper to allow you to get the kind of work that you want to do, if you have the opportunity to just go straight to the kind of work you want to do, take it. And you know, you could always go back and get the piece of paper if that matters to you. And I think, like, here I am during COVID, I'm not even going to re-enroll Josie back in public school because they only do about 90 minutes of learning a day. And I think she'll learn more. I mean, she's already doing more work, working on her art and building her own skills and talents and reading on her own. And she's doing the public school Zoom meetings. But on top of that, she's co-hosting Scam Nation with me. And I feel like she's getting more out of all of that than she would going to public school. And so I have to feel like if that's true, then I have to extend out the possibility that maybe, you know, I know so many people who have done so well and are so smart and have become so successful without bothering with a college education. I don't know. I'm not entirely convinced all my kids are going to go to college.
I certainly think that going out there and making something is kind of what the key is. And, you know, I used to do an after school program on critical thinking and, you know, talking to kids right before they're going off to college. And I had this, you know, experience where right after high school, I went off and I worked as a magician overseas on cruise ships and all that. And I remember once I had a kid say, "Hey, I think I want to do what you did, you know, and not go to college next year." And I'm like, dude, like, I went from high school to being really well paid on as a magician, like, you know, 6 months contracts here and there. I said, if you have that option, then I would say yes. If you're like, I just want to figure myself out and you're not really nothing, you don't have a project, you have nothing, then I'm like, I don't know if that's really the best sort of thing. I'm, you know, I've strangely been more of an advocate for some people. Like, if you don't have that thing, then I'm like, yeah, get into school as quickly as possible, because otherwise it creates that pattern for the rest of your life.
Yeah, definitely. If you don't know what you want to do, go to college. If you hope that you're going to enter a ladder kind of situation, then yes, get that paper. Do that thing. Show that you can see something through to completion. But if you're an off the beaten path person, and you have the opportunity to go straight into getting real experience, then go there immediately.
Yeah, I think that. Yeah, it's you know, my dad's advice to me, and again, we have somebody in the chat says, I'm going to try and nail down what my kids want to do before they go to college. I went on assuming now I'd figure it out and never really did. And I think that's the problem, is that, like, my dad was like, if you're not in school, then you got to be doing something. You got to be out there doing something. You can't just sit around and be like, hey, I'm going to, you know, figure it out. And then no. And then Link brings up, you know, the student loan debt and all that. I think that's the other part of it. Like, we have an amazing community college program in our country. We have a fantastic community college program in our country, and it is an inexpensive way to figure out what the heck you want to do. And you go do 2 years of community college, just about any college in the country will be open to you.
Yeah, what especially because what they're really seeing is you following through on a plan. You know, it's that's the biggest worry that a college has, and almost all of those credits are instantly transferable. In fact, there was somebody who had an AP credit. My roommate had an AP credit that was not accepted by the University of Texas, but was accepted by Austin Community College. So he just transferred it to Austin Community College. And then transferred the Austin Community College credit over to the University of Texas.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense.
You know, I think my firebrand kind of like college is a sham take, which was something that I formulated in college, is mostly about the promise and the money and what I think gets kind of whitewashed into our general discussion about stuff like this is that everybody should be going to college or you're not succeeding. And that's what I really wanted to kind of, that I always try to push against, because on one hand, some people don't, right? Some people really should just, you know, if you're already coding, then, you know, take whatever other coding boot camp to make sure that you're up on what things are doing, and then see whether or not you can get a gig doing what do you want to do. If you are looking for something, then have no fear about taking some time off before you plug into this massive financial obligation, which for many people affects them well into their late 30s, as we are seeing, even with my generation. My generation is paying, I think, 40% what tuition is now for kids. So I think that There's those two levels. And then when you are, if you do go to college, maximize your time there, because the idea that this is this rite of passage, and it feels culturally that we talk about it in the same way as like high school, where it's like, discover who you are, meet your new friends, that kind of stuff, is to me very like, we should be thinking of college as, no, you're on the clock now. Now go do stuff. Now go explore. Now go create. And even if you're only going to college and you decide that a thing that you thought you liked isn't what you like anymore, that's a valuable skill compared to just floating and hoping that life hits you in the face like a fish with what your destiny is supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just a big believer, like, just go out and do stuff. Like, just, you're not going to find yourself sitting in front of your video game console, unless you're, you know, video games are your passion, you know, but my friends that never lived up to their potential, you know, some were the ones that went to college, drifted through classes, then dropped out, not because they found a passion, but because they just didn't like being in the disciplined environment. And then the rest of their life showed that. They showed that they just didn't do well in disciplined environments. And I think that's, you know, I think that's the, you know, the unfortunate part. So, yeah, I had a very unconventional path, but, you know, people who finish things and make things, that's what impresses me. And for some people, it's, yeah, I wanted to go here and I got the 4-year degree from that. Great. Other people, it's like, I wanted to go out and, I was really into cycling, so I decided to spend, 2 years as a cyclist and going around the world doing that and going to all these different cycling clubs. And so that'd be a cool thing, you know, be that too.
Well, I think the important part of your story, Andrew, is that you put yourself in a position where you were obligated to show up on time and perform and do the gig. And, you know, in a world where maybe there's two paths, like University of Texas has one of the last acting degrees in the country. All of that is a simulation of what you were actually doing, working mm-hmm. for money at the cruise ships. Right. So it's like, I have to feel now, granted, you didn't have as many mentors available or as many people to, you know, give you feedback or notes after every single show. But in the meantime, you were straight in the work. And I would suggest that you're probably better off for it.
You know, that brings up a topic, though. I think we could probably do that for after things, is talk about mentorship, because although I did have a number of people who gave me, I was able to do it because I had a number of people that when I started off as a teenager, took an interest in what I was doing and gave me advice. And so, I mean, how do you go from 18? I mean, I had to lie about my age to get work on cruise ships, too. When I was 18, I said I was like 23. And was able to pull it off, but that was part of it. But I mean, another factor was like, I had people who had, since I was 15, gave me advice and stuff. And so I had kind of, you know, put together sort of, you know, an ad hoc sort of this, my own sort of education in that, you know, learning about illusion building from this person, learning about presence from first person, learning about costumes and stuff from somebody else. So I guess that's, I think that'd be a great after things topic, talking about finding mentors and being a mentor.
Well, speaking of college, Brian said that not all of his girls may or may not go, but if you want to ensure that they're enrolled, even if it's just for laughs, then you need to go to patreon.com/weirdthings and give us money, because this stuff isn't cheap. And Brian has a lot of tuition, and boy, is it coming up a lot faster than he would have thought.
this is getting too real right now.
So head on over there, patreon.com/weirdthings. It's where we fund the show. Get your custom RSS feed, get the shows quicker than you would otherwise, and get our After Things show where we talk about a little bit more. If you like this, this is a way more of an After Things kind of topic. So if you like this, then you will love the After Things podcast.
Hey, Dad, I hear USC's got a higher math requirement right now. Brian Googles USC tuition costs. math.
Yeah. You don't need it.
So we're talking before the story is drones over power plants. So due to a Freedom Information Act request, some investigators were able to pull up some reports, apparently, from the NRC, which is the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which talked about how there's been instances where swarms of drones have been spotted over nuclear power plants.
I
Five.
By default, want to just assume these are film students, but it occurs to me that foreign powers might have an interest in high-detailed shots of power plants.
Yeah. It's a curious, like, they've seen, like, multiples at a time doing this and checking this out. And
so I wonder, you know, because drone technology now has advanced so much that you can transmit stuff that is being recorded. Obviously, the highest fidelity is probably going to come from a camera that you then land back. But if you literally just wanted to get free looks at these places and all you did was fly a drone, understanding that it's broadcasting back to you and it just never lands and you never recover it, that's worth it if you get the right looky-loos.
Yeah, that's as a matter of fact, the last three or four times I used our drone, it was just because I wanted to get an idea of what the landscape would look like from one story up, two stories up, three stories up. And it's much easier to just do screen capture on your iPhone than to bother to download off an SD card and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, just reading through the report here talking about, you know, there are people like, well, there's not much damage a drone could do. But I think we all just assumed, well, surveillance, you know, the idea that you're trying to look at that. And one of the things that we've talked about before, but I'll bring up again, is that when you look at Google Maps, you're not actually looking at
satellite
reality.
Yeah.
A lot of it's actually like the stuff we look at is actually from airplanes and stuff, too.
Right.
Is that they use that for that. But it's. Certain things are like Disney World isn't necessarily what Disney World looks like because they have security concerns. If you look at, let's say, Air Force bases or military bases, that stuff has changed and whatever and altered to protect secrets. And nuclear power plants, things like that, that's probably something that falls in line there with what you see on that map is probably not what it really the layout is. And so I wouldn't surprise me if you had actors of a foreign country were curious to find out, you know, what is this layout like of this probing the fences? I mean, I'm sure we do it with other countries.
So to what tangible benefit? I understand like the general concept of, you know, if there was a doorknob, you want to grab it and twist it and see if it opens or if it's locked or not. But getting more sinister beyond that, I mean, I guess power plants, you would want critical infrastructure to be on your list. Somebody somewhere has to have a strike list as their job. Like somebody wakes up in the morning, gets their Starbucks and says, oh, I'm only 13 through my 23 best power plants to shoot.
Well, yeah. I mean, this was a thing a little bit, you know, it was kind of a relic of an era where we didn't care about politics all that much, but it happened a few times during the Clinton and Bush administrations where in a dead spot for political coverage, there'd be like some magazine article or some newspaper article that would say like the secret war with China plan. And it's like, oh, they're deep in the bowels of the Pentagon. There's a group of people that are working on what a war with Russia would look like, what a war with China would look like. And it's always conspiratorial posited as like, we're going to go to war with Russia or China, where I always looked at it as like, well, they better, you know how much money we pay for the Pentagon? There better be a team of people that are planning for exactly what would happen in case. You never know when this stuff is going to spin up. And at that point, we don't want people running around, you know, like chickens with their head cut off saying, ah, nobody planned for this. Nobody planned for this. Of course they should have at least a rough draft.
Yeah. Somebody brought up, like, don't other countries have their own satellites? Yeah. And this is more of an instance of the redaction came after 9/11, where it wasn't really nation states were worried about as much as terrorist groups or whatever that, as far as we know, don't have satellites. And also other even domestic actors and stuff is to just sort of limit the availability of that knowledge. You know, some things you're not going to be able to protect 100%, but, you know, if you had, you know, like hypothetically a military, like an Air Force base, whatever, and there was an exposed, you know, fuel line at some point that you knew was a critical part of the infrastructure that you didn't want people knowing about. You're like, oh, well, that's a target right there. You know, we can just hit that or something. And I'm, you know, making something up, like, a transformer location or something.
Sure. So, but it almost in some ways is reminiscent of like betting markets or whatever, where it's like even grabbing civilians and saying, hey, pretend this is a video game. Where you have five strikes. Where would you put them? And then somebody happens to know. It's like, well, this one, why? Wait, no, nobody said that one. Why? It's like, oh, well, because that's a major power conduit. I'm an electrician. I happen to know these things, you know. So it's like there's value in knowing those surprise elements, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, this exhaust port, there's no problem here.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. And that is a curious sort of thing that, if you talk to people who are in like network security and stuff, and every day, like the Pentagon gets hammered with attacks coming from out, you know, from other sort of unknown attacks trying to probe networks, government agencies, government authorities, businesses, et cetera. And there is both the military use, there's also the foreign powers trying to get access to corporate secrets and stuff. It is a very, very, very common thing. And it's, you know, it's why you have companies like Cloudflare now, which, yeah, we had a Cloudflare outage and we realized, oh, wow, the internet really runs on Cloudflare. And, you know, that's, you know, and we, you know, not to say, oh, so, those other people picking on us, we do it too.
Sorry, I actually missed the Cloudflare outage. What's the story on that one?
They had about 2 weeks ago, a week ago, they had a outage where a lot of, like, for a couple hours, like a lot of sites you could get access to, Slack, other things, a big chunk of the internet wasn't working because they were all using Cloudflare as, you know, the DNS.
And this is, for those of you who are not aware, Cloudflare is a service that prevents your website, theoretically prevents your website from going down. That if there is a large influx or a DDoS or something that is there to maliciously take down your site, or you just get a ton of traffic in a moment, back in the day, it would take your website down. Cloudflare, now a very, very successful solution to make sure that never happens. And so when that goes down, it's similar with like AWS or Azure or any of these cloud services that so many things are built on now. You realize, like, when AWS, some dingus entered a wrong command into a spreadsheet, and next thing you know, half the internet is down because half the internet uses AWS.
Yeah, and that was a Cloudflare. It turned out it was an internal thing because people were concerned because this was the site that you used to prevent, you know, bad things from happening, and all of a sudden goes down. But it turned out they hired Peter Dingus from AWS to go work for
them. Yeah, that was it. Of the Alabama dinguses, you know, always causing trouble.
Another interesting story is scientists, and again, there's absolutely nothing scary about this whatsoever, is they were took some samples from the ocean underneath kind of a layer where it was very, very cold. You know, it'd been like kind of well preserved. And they found some 100 million year old microbes that were able to spring to life. They were able to resuscitate them and get them back up and running. They were 101 million years old.
Like,
so they started munching and multiplying.
This is not a clone of it. This is not the offspring of it. This is the actual living thing just frozen for that long and then made alive again.
Well, that's where the story between the headline and you try to get into the details of what they're trying to say there was either they were in a kind of a hibernated state or very slowly reproducing there. You know, been going through the story here trying to figure out like, okay, what are you trying to say? Because exactly the question came up like, because first it's like, well, you know, if they brought these things back, that seems amazing. But apparently they'd been trapped down there for basically a fasting state. And from this, it seems to make it clear that they were, I would assume that they would continue to have it sort of, you know, reproduce because I just think you would just get natural sort of degeneration.
I guess, but I guess it's not the craziest thing. Like I can imagine some seeds that, or brine shrimp eggs that were, you know, in a cozy storage position and then, you know, last long enough. Cause it's like, I mean, those things, like they just hang out until it's time to go and grow.
Yeah. They seem to imply, they think that perhaps that they were able to like slowly reproduce, you know, whatever, that's where it gets fuzzy. But the idea is they've been separate, you know, 100 million year old there. These are things that were, you know, around before, like the T-Rex.
So crazy.
Which is, yeah, that's the crazy part is that. And, you know, because if you get, if it was just without being able to reproduce, the problem is that you do get the DNA decay. Like you have that sort of half-life of DNA and there are exceptions where that doesn't apply, but it's just, it is the implications for this though, is like, if we go to Mars, and some of the conditions here might be conditions we might find on Mars too. And that's sort of kind of the exciting prospect is the idea that you was there that were, you know, if there was life, ever life on there, if there was ever life on Mars at one point, the possibility that it could still be there might be there.
Yeah. So have we talked about this on Weird Things? I was talking about this with the kids and for all I know, maybe we just talked about it last week, but, intertwined trees on the side of a mountain. Did we already talk about this? The
clones.
Okay. Yeah. So somebody was saying like, hey, that entire side of the mountain, that's all one organism. It's all one tree. And whether that's true in so far as, you know, all the trees are sprigs of each other, they're all clones, essentially, they're all genetically identical, or whether it's true in that they're so intermingled that their root network is indistinguishable from them being separate trees. Like essentially that entire side of a Colorado mountain is one organism, should be thought of as essentially one organism. Is that right? Or am I going too far afield here?
I guess question there would be, can you kill, like, you know, if you kill one, does that hurt the larger structure?
I'd imagine the rules are the same. Like if I prune one limb off of a tree, I'm not killing the tree. I'm just pruning a limb from it, you know?
Yeah.
So, but if you introduce a toxin or a poison, I don't know.
Yeah. So they I guess say that would be Pando, my question.
Pando is is a clonal colony of a quaking aspen determined to be a single living organism by identical genetic markers and assumed to have one massive underground root system. And it is in the Fremont River Range in Fish Lake Forest, which is in Utah, but on the Colorado Plateau. And the root system is estimated to be 80,000 years old.
That's amazing. So,
yeah. I mean, you could pull one of those things out somewhere else and plant it. It would be fine. But they are.
But it would be a clone sprig of from mm-hmm. that one giant colony. Wow.
Yeah, there's interesting sort of like largest plants like the giant sequoia is the largest single stem tree by wood volume and mass, and then there's another the Poicetania oceanica, which is a seagrass. And apparently there is like a section of like a continuous sort of seagrass section where they're all related. Very curious. I mean, yeah, it's fascinating. And that's actually a topic that I was going to bring up is, I think it was, I watched an interview and I think maybe it was his 101st birthday, Lovelock, who came up with the whole, you know, idea of, you know, the Gaia idea of looking at the Earth as an entire, you know, ecosystem.
Oh, yeah.
So,
a single organism, yeah.
Yeah, so James Lovelock, he just had his 101st birthday. Guess when he was working for NASA or doing a NASA project, he was looking at the Earth as a whole ecosystem and thought, like, you could look at this as an entire, you know, living system. And there's an interview with him on BBC. He's 101 and he is sharp as hell. And it is just really worth checking out. You know, he's just poignant, you know, just is, you know, he's a charming, very interesting guy who, you know, has, you know, was an early environmentalist, one of the early people to really say, hey, these systems are all connected. And if you do tremendous damage to one, it affects the others, et cetera. And we need to pay attention to this. And, you know, so just anything to watch and to just, you know, you watch this guy talk and like, he's 101 and he's more articulate than I am now.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. We're not even listening to him, but just like, just his manner.
His presence. Yeah.
Yeah. No, he seems like a somebody literally 50 years younger than he is.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's gone from, he was one of the people to first sort of, you know, kind of, you know, try to bring on about warnings about this. And, you know, he's talked about like, we need to go nuclear, you know, we need to go these things. If we want to protect our environment, it's the safest, cleanest way to go about doing that. And, you know, he's put that forth, but, you know, that made him controversial. And he's a guy that's like, hey, yeah, no, we can really damage our environment. We need to find the best solutions for it.
You know what happened since our last episode? I believe it was Tuesday of last week. So it was just one day after Weird Things. But didn't SpaceX do their test where they made a building fly?
next topic on the list.
Yeah.
So
it looks so bizarre. It looks so bizarre. It's like a grain silo just says, I need to go back to my home planet. Psych.
Insane.
I'm coming home.
Or a Budweiser commercial. So SpaceX, they're developing Starship, which was interesting because that got a shout out by Jim Bridenstine talking about the next generation of space vehicles after we had the wonderful Crew Dragon test. And what we're looking at here is this ridiculously absurd gigantic cylinder, which is actually basically about 2/3 of what will be the upper stage of the Starship, with one Raptor engine. This will eventually have 3 engines. It's got one Raptor engine. If you look at the bottom of the thrust, you notice that it's off-centered because it will not be in the middle. It will be off to the side, and yet the thing still flies, and it's able to go back down and land.
It's insane. You know, it is bonkers. It is so sideways and so surreal. And to know that they're only doing it with 1/3 of the engine redundancy that they're eventually going to have, man, what a kudos on the successful ridiculous hop.
It looks like a Amazon A-word, right? it looks like just a cylinder like that is so massive in the same proportions as one of those home speaker devices in relation to your desk. That's what that is to the landscape of Texas. Like that's how large it looms, and it moves up and down so easy with 1/3 of the capacity it's going to have. And I know we've said this before, but I would like to underline it again. SpaceX, a company that was started because Elon Musk wanted to have a greenhouse on Mars and live stream it so people would be fascinated by space. They have maintained a commitment as they've gone forward to make these tests as telegenic as possible and to make these visuals as widely available as they can. And I really think that matters. I think that in terms of when we talk about science education, when we talk about pushing kids into engineering and STEM, this is the kind of stuff that I think captures imaginations and it captures the hearts and minds of people, because it looks insane. You've never seen this before, and inherently it's telling a story that I think can only lead to good and better things, but amazing visuals.
Is my sense of scale off on this, Andrew? I perceive it as a three-story tall grain silo. Am I over or under on that?
Oh, you're way under. If you go to, Bryce, if you want to go look up Starship Scale, or if you go to the Reddit for that, you can see some photos for this where you see how much smaller people are. I think this is like, I want to say like 10 stories tall or something. I mean, it's just, it's incredibly huge.
Wow.
And again, there's going to be another third on top of there. There's going to be a cap and a, you know, crew compartment, cargo, et cetera.
And then of course, a first stage underneath it, that'll launch it up and then land itself.
Have like 30 some of those engines on it.
That's so crazy.
And this is, there has been a lot of talk lately where, because of the Crew Dragon test was such a nice success, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the NASA, you know, SpaceX partnership and what they've learned from each other. There's been some talk about, like, you know, the what they've learned from each other, et cetera. And one of the things that NASA's talked about, like, they had to get over the idea is SpaceX was like, you know, we can spend a year and we can try to figure out everything can go wrong, but the best way to do it is to build it and see what goes wrong. And that was ended up being a much faster sort of way to iterate for them. And that's where, you know, because it in theoretically, like, no, if you build hardware and it's destroyed, oh, it costs a lot. I'm like, no, you figure out how to build a bunch of hardware, then you get a lot of shots at it. Where if you spend 2 years building this design and then you find something that reality says, no, this won't work, you know, it's problematic. So next steps are going to be, they're going to do some more of these hops, more of these hop tests, whatever. Again, this is testing the engine, the fuel stack, et cetera, for that. They're then going to, if they go, there's a whole community of people that take photos of everything they can around there. There's tons of nose cones. They're building already. This is like, this was SN6, like serial number 6. They've already got like SN8 being built. They're changing, they're iterating. They've got nose cones planned with like reaction control thrusters and stuff in there. They've got the winglets being made, et cetera. And so they're going to keep doing this. The goal is then to do a 20-kilometer hop with something that will look a lot closer to this. Then they're going to try to do the belly flop maneuver, because the way this thing is going to land, I think we talked about a long time ago, is thing's going to go up, the upper stage go up, go orbital. Then when it comes back down, it's going to do this sort of skydiver belly flop maneuver, where it's going to use that to sort of, you know, basically get rid of a lot of its velocity and then start, you know, to then basically even out and then land.
Wow, that's gonna look so insane. That's gonna be that's gonna be one of the coolest things ever seen in society, to look at that gigantic grain silo go flat out and then readjust to land.
Then the maneuver is called the psych. You know, it's like it's just coming straight down, like, we're all gonna, oh no, it's fine.
yeah.
And that gets into, like, you know, just the crazy, you know, the crazy physics of it all. Like the shuttle, if you separate a lot of the problems of that program, how expensive it was, what we could have, and everything else, you just focus on just the engineering of it alone. The shuttle was amazing. You know, the shuttle, you know, also, the shuttle, you know,
fairly conventional. Glider. Like I can wrap my mind around how the shuttle works. It's like you got the blasters that get them up and they fall into the sea. You got the tank that it rides all the way up into orbit and you drop that. And then time to come home. Just, I know how an airplane lands. You know, like I can grok all of that.
But still, an airplane that glides down from space.
Yep.
You know, that's the thing that goes from, you know, 18,000 miles an hour to stopping on a runway with, you know, drag chutes on the runway. But that was an amazing, you know, it really, really was sort of, and this is going to be a different way of doing this, because, you know, the shuttle was a giant glider when it came in. And then this is going to be more of like, hey, I'm skydiving from space. Woo, look at me. And then even out, you know, which the wings are going to have to actively move to adjust the way it's doing, et cetera. God.
Just, I'm already thrilled. You know, it's, crazy. I mean, the theme of this podcast, what awesome times to live in terms of space travel. And that has only continued in 2020. Nothing else has continued. Everything else broken. Everything else awful. 2020's one consistency is space remains dope.
Yep. The so the plan is we may see that 20-kilometer hop this year. You know, we may see, you know, I don't know if we're going to see orbital this year, but the plan is still to try to even go orbital this year. You know, we're going to see they're going to have to build the other engine stack there. And then this is a rocket. This is designed to go to Mars. You're looking at, imagine going and watch them testing parts of Apollo. You know, this is we're watching, you know, testing for a thing that's not just a one shot to Mars, but a factory to build Mars rockets. This is the factory where they build the rockets that go to Mars, not the rocket to go to Mars, but the rockets.
Andrew Heaton asked me on his podcast how confident I was on a scale of 1 to 10 that I would personally ever go to space. And I can strongly say that after watching that hop, that grain silo fly and land itself, I have never, ever been more confident that, I mean, like, 40 more years, we got this. Like, I'm going to go to space, and I'm so stoked.
I've never been more confident that I'm never going to go to space because it looks terrifying. that was a minor bit of news is Virgin. God, I lose track of which Virgin space companies, but Virgin. Virgin Galactic has said that they're also, hey, we're going to build a supersonic jet, which has been an interesting sort of revelation. Like, yeah, like, no, oh, okay. It's not space, but cool. All right. Cool. So there is that, I think we talked about before. There's a new generation of supersonic aircraft being developed. There's a company Boom, which is developing its supersonic jet, and now Virgin Galactic says they want to do that because I guess enough people looked at it and said, hey, materials have gotten better, efficiencies are better, we're way past where the Concorde was, and we could build something that is going to be able to do this. We're looking at Bryce has already found the website for this. So the XB1, this is a demo. They're going to go test or they're doing a rollout, which I guess just, you know, we're going to look at a bunch of carbon fiber and go, oh, I guess it'll be cool flying. But their plans are to develop this. I guess they're working with the Japan Airlines to do this. So we're looking at Boom. Wait, is this Boom site, right? Okay, sorry, I got them confused here.
Yeah, this is boomsupersonic.com.
By the way, what a flex to name your company Boom. Like that is some confidence at the jump. You're like, no, we are bold in that we are calling our supersonic jet company Boom.
It's a bit, but it's an exciting thing to see there's, you know, that much interest now to start developing. You know, this is getting things faster, getting places faster. I think would be cool.
Yeah.
So, gentlemen, picks.
I got the kids to watch Contact over the weekend. Carl Sagan wrote the book. Robert Zemeckis did the movie. Jodie Foster stars in it. Tom Skerritt plays the best a-hole you've ever seen Tom Skerritt play. Parts of it aged very, very well. Other parts, feel a little bit dated. Mid-90s technology was different. But highly recommended. If you've never taken the trip, I recommend it.
And McConaughey in the first epoch of McConaughey.
Yeah.
Like, there was like 90s McConaughey. And
Pretty
that
Boy
was, that was
McConaughey,
a,
yeah.
Yeah, and that was like prestige McConaughey. And then it kind of like sort of fell off, and then he rose like a phoenix yet again. But I remember watching Contact in theaters, but it's been a little bit since I saw it.
You know, I remember when it came out, because it came out after Carl Sagan had passed away, and there was some discussion about whether or not Zemeckis' interpretation
would approve of it. Yeah.
Yeah, and moving past that, though, one of the things that I thought was kind of interesting was the idea that I'm going to get into spoiler territory here for all of you who haven't seen it.
For this 23-year-old movie. What? Is there contact in the movie Contact?
there are 22-year-olds out there going, what? So at the end of it, it comes down to, and like they tried to sort of like the movie tried to put the idea of kind of put science on the same level as like faith. And I think that I found that like, that's, you know, one works one, maybe not so much, but, I think that, I mean, for certain applications, yes. But, what I did like was that the billionaire who was able to build the backup, you know, machine. And after this thing happens and she has this experience and there's evidence of something weird happening, but nothing conclusive, that the idea was it was a hoax. I loved the idea that people were able to convince themselves, you know what? Maybe we never heard from aliens. Maybe this was a trick by this billionaire to make us think that there were aliens, and very much in a Watchmen-esque sort of way. And I kind of, from a storytelling point, like I dig that idea that like, cause I think that when we have an amazing thing happen, and I'm not making predictions, but I think something amazing is going to happen. Andrew rolls his eyes as he says that, but we will have that. Like if the first time we find, let's say we think we found microbes on Mars, we're going to be like, well, was it contamination? We went through this with the Mars asteroid. Was it contamination? Was it this? And then like, yeah, but did it come from Earth? And is it really just an Earth thing? Is it isolated? Or if we ever get a signal from space, it's going to be, you know, there will be, we're not going to have, we're not going to know, the certainty will not be there. We don't, we're not certain about anything that we, facts are gone and whatnot. So I love that idea. They're all nodding in agreement.
Yes. No, that is cool. Hey, I got a pick. So, Ashley and I last Friday were watching Mucho Mucho Amor, and after we were done, we still had a little bit of time before we wanted to go to sleep, so we were just kind of flipping through Netflix, and I saw a thing that I was very excited by, and that is a Frank Sinatra documentary, and I was excited, and then Ashley clicked over to it, and I got even more excited when she said, oh, wait a minute, this is just the first season. First season of a Sinatra documentary. Indeed, it is Alex Gibney's All or Nothing at All. It is two parts. I don't know if they'll do a second season. I'm about two thirds through it now. It's about 4 hours total. If you are a Sinatra fan, it is fairly comprehensive. It's very, it involves a lot of the family, a lot of first person stuff, both from Sinatra and Sinatra's family. So they really downplay certain allegations of salacious stories, specifically involving the mob in his early days, but then wind up going whole hog on some of the mob stuff that involves the Kennedys, which of course the Sinatra had a falling out with them. As a Sinatra fan, I was delighted by it. It was the kind of comprehensive story that I kind of would still love for there to be about a lot of contemporary artists, including like, you know, the Beastie Boys and stuff like that. People that are, you know, I think when it comes to musical artists that especially have become kind of iconic, I would love to see similar 4 hour, heavy into, archival footage and sound kind of treatments like this, including the moment where Sinatra kind of in a lull in his career, about to get fired from his record label, does a novelty song that I didn't even know existed, that apparently Sinatra loathes, but it's from the same guy who made How Much Is That Doggy in the Window. There's another dog-centric Sinatra Dreams About Dogs Yelling at Each Other love song that is intensely terrible and Sinatra hated, but
no undead creatures are dancing in this one, just to be clear.
No undead creatures dancing in this particular okay. one, but yeah, All or Nothing at All.
Let me ask you a question. When you get documentaries like that where they get access from the family and some of the permission from the family, and I'm not going to get into Frank Sinatra specifically, but I can think of other like musicians who, if you did an honest documentary, they would be canceled.
Yes.
You know, and I would say there's probably aspects in his life that were, they brought to light, people would go, oh, that's horrible. That is absolutely horrible. And I just wonder if that's sort of like, it is a very interesting sort of era we live in where.
As a Sinatra documentary, it's a very interesting documentary about the Kennedys because Frank Sinatra and Frank Sinatra's family love to point out everything bad that happened with the Kennedys because of the eventual falling out. And it's a lot of stuff. I was, you know, I watched it in one part because I talk about those elements in Raise the Dead, in the first season of Raise the Dead. And so I kind of like, I'm watching it with like fingers like crossed that I didn't screw some major thing up, that they now have other archival footage or sound to kind of totally rebut. And they don't, which is good. But so I felt better about myself in doing the podcast, but it's interesting to see what we are willing to leave in the history books and how we feel about certain people, because that the documentary, specifically this one, it doesn't mince words about you know, the Kennedys that would eventually go on to be known as a big civil rights trailblazers, refused to have Sammy Davis Jr. at the inauguration because he was getting about to go through an interracial marriage that he postponed for the Kennedys, and then he was also banned from the inauguration, and that's an element of hypocrisy, and that's before we even get into all the personal stuff like Andrew was talking about.
I didn't know he got Kanye'd by the Kennedys.
They were not pleased that he would dare to get have an interracial marriage. By the way, his wife, Sammy Davis's wife that caused all that problem, Mae Britt, still alive.
There's a, have you ever seen a Saturday Night Live sketch where Will Ferrell plays this, like, sounds like this old time kind of rock and roll guy, Chucky Lee Bird. And his, you know, songs are like, you know, she was 13 and beautiful. He's on a piano playing this. They do. It's a great sketch because, like, they're doing this sort of thing where all, like, it's like this commercial, like, for this, oh, the Chucky Lee Bird greatest hits, and like this, and the two hosts are like, that just doesn't sound right. You know, you're like, I met her in middle school, and like, they're like, I guess it was a different time. Like, no, that song came out last year, and you realize he's not an old-time musician. He's a modern-day guy singing all these creepy sort of songs. And so, the Will Ferrell. Yeah, Chucky Lee Bird.
And by the way, that would probably be one of the few Will Ferrell sketches. There's some Will Ferrell sketches that really don't age well. That are very, very interesting.
Yeah.
Other picks? I got a pick here. We are watching a new show for Cord Killer Spoiler in Time, and it meant that I had to get access to CBS All Access. And that gave me the opportunity to watch something that I'd wanted to see when it came out last year, and I didn't watch it because why would I get CBS All Access? I don't watch The Good Wife. I don't watch NCIS. But what I have been enjoying is going through
The Good Wife and NCIS.
the two most popular shows on TV, I guess. I got into Jordan Peele's 2019 adaptation of The Twilight Zone.
How is it?
It's pretty good. You know, thinking about all of the other anthology series that have been coming out lately, and I think have been rather weak, I think that this is pretty good. Some of them, like, there's definitely one that's like also on an airplane, and they even see it in the credits, like, based off of the other airplane episode of The Twilight Zone from
Richard Matheson's Terror 20,000 Feet.
Yeah, so this was Terror at 30,000 feet, and it's they got a lot of like good, like, I don't know, actors that I recognize. Like in that one, it's Adam Scott and Dan Carlin, who is the voice of a podcast about the plane that he's on and the mysterious tragedy of it.
The same Dan Carlin that I'm thinking of when you say the words Dan Carlin?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That episode stopped me from, I tried to watch the next one. That one alone, like, I'm a big Richard Matheson. Matheson fan, who's a guy that wrote like some of the great iconic sci-fi stories of King Twilight Zone episodes, amazing TV writer, whatever writer. And I'm not like, oh, he's so sacred, you can't touch it. But like, you're watching this thing and he starts listening to this podcast, predicting things are going to happen, which one got rid of the most awesome element of Terror at 20,000 feet. Freaking, there's something on the wing. But I'm like, great. Let somebody else listen to it.
Well, he never happens. It does happen in the second half. But my thing is like, why don't you just skip to the end? Why don't you just skip to the, I don't know. I don't know why you don't.
Yeah, skip exactly. Around, that's the other thing. Is you're like, it takes forever to do that. He does it. He just like, yeah, find out what's good. I'm like, it didn't feel to me like whoever wrote that or whatever committee put that together had really read a lot of like Twilight Zone scripts or whatever. It's like they kind of understood the idea of one. Because then it was like the ending is just like, what?
I think the thing I've been enjoying most about it, because it makes me think a lot about the Electric Dreams anthology that Amazon Prime Video did with all the Philip K. Dick stories. And watching that series, it's very tough because that, I think, tries to stick really strongly to Philip K. Dick's twists and his sort of turns. And you realize, like, oh, these are like 40 years old. We've been doing these twists already. Where this is really not twist heavy or like this kind of settles into the kind of catastrophes that are a part of the concepts. And I think that makes it feel that kind of, I don't know, smooths out some of the hard edges on it. But I've enjoyed it. And someone in the chat is saying that the second season that they did, I guess this year, is supposed to be even better. So I'm digging it. I'm only for halfway through the first season, but it's pretty cool. Twilight Zone.
Very cool.
Andrew?
So my pick is I decided to kind of like tune out of it this weekend and not actually work. And I hadn't been playing with my Oculus Quest much. And I got a game from it, and it's called The Room. It's by Fireproof Games. They're the ones that make like the little escape, like the little, like the room for the iPhone, I think Android games, which are these solve these puzzles, you're in this room, go around, whatever. Theirs have always been much better than everybody else's because the puzzles I always thought were really well. The story was neat, but it's not like the game, you know, like games where you have to keep notebooks and keep track of a ton of stuff. They're pretty solvable, and clues are available if you need them. And they always seem to put more into it than you think. You know, you get to the end and there's like a bonus layer or whatever, which I really dig. So this was their first VR game. So instead of looking at this on your phone, you're actually in the room, walking around, playing with objects and solving things. And I enjoyed the heck out of this. You know, I got several hours of gameplay out of this. I thought the puzzles were really fun and engaging. It can be a little spooky and mysterious at times. So it's got like a 4.9 rating on the Oculus Store. So nice.
They always really good jobs with the room games. I think in terms of making puzzle box type games, it's very easy to make a cheap, hard puzzle that kind of doesn't, you know, there's no reason for anything, but I think they make a good job of making it make sense, giving it a really interesting aesthetic and trying to make it feel like there's a whole world of weird things going on.
Yeah, so I to me, it was just a very fun experience. And it's one of those things, I'm enjoying this now, and then it's like thinking, where will VR be in 10 years? And so, again, if you're looking at VR, I would say get the Quest, but there may be coming out with a new Quest in a month or so. That's the rumor, or maybe it might be pushed to next year, but they're actually going to take the Quest, and the rumors are coming out with kind of a more compact model because that's been just a huge hit for them, just a huge hit. And the Quest is the VR headset that you don't need to connect it to your computer. It's all self-contained. You just pop the thing on and start playing. You don't have to put any sensors around your room. It's got really good, really, really good spatial sensing. And you can even use it without your controllers now for some games. So it'll look at your hands and it'll tell where your hand positions are so you can move things. So,
wow, nice.
You know, it's fun. Cool. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.